1924, Liberty performed a rather interesting survey. They selected at random 100 people, and they sent them a letter, and enclosed within that letter was a $1 bill, explaining that as a result of adjusting an error that these people had made, that they were owed $1. 27 people returned the dollar bill, saying that Liberty had made the mistake and not them. They conducted the same survey in 1971, and this time 13 people returned the $1 bill. Probably when you were growing up, you heard a lot about this thing called character. Everybody was supposed to have it, but everybody didn't. And those who didn't were referred to as characters. Webster defines character this way. He says, it is morally uprightness, or moral uprightness, freedom from corruption, honesty. Basically, as Ted Engstrom defines a sister word, it is doing exactly what you said you would do. That's character. A businessman in our church told me that a client of his placed a very large order. It was a surprise, and it was also an emergency situation, and they needed the supplies by the next afternoon. Now, this was an order twice as large as any order this client had ever requested. But this businessman told me he knew that he could not get it for at least 2, maybe 3 days. Now, had he signed the contract, he said, he told me, he knew that they would have to wait then, and he would get the job. But he was within a breath of telling them to call his competitor, and maybe they had it on hand. That is, and he did that, what you call character. It is not promising something that you cannot produce. It is fulfilling everything that you said you would do. Now, maybe it's something small, like taking your turn in the carpool when you recognize now you wish you had never signed on. It may mean keeping an appointment with a person that you don't particularly like, or making those phone calls in the afternoon when you're already bone tired. Or it may be something very significant. It may be fulfilling the promise to your child to take them fishing when you said you would. It may mean fulfilling that ministry responsibility after you signed on, after you've realized how difficult it is to accomplish it. Maybe showing up when you said you'd show up. Maybe it's remaining married to that person that you married when they turned out differently than you might have thought they would. That's exactly the kind of pickle Joshua finds himself in. I invite your attention to chapter 9. He has just been fooled by an Oscar-winning performance by the Gibeonites. They've come on with their old clothes and their worn-out wineskins. They've got to prove to Joshua that they live in a far-off country. God told Moses those who lived in a far-off country would be allowed to live in a servitude type of role. And so they had to prove to Joshua they didn't live 20 minutes away, which they did, but they lived a far-off distance. And so they appear with their worn-out clothes and they say, Joshua, look, our sandals are worn out, our wineskins are old and they're patched, and our clothing is worn out. We are from a far-off country. And Joshua bought the lies, as we studied in our last session, because he didn't go to God first. Now look at verse 15. Let's review at least that. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant, that's a promise, with them, and let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. Now the text tells us in 3 days they will discover these Gibeonites live 20 minutes away. They thought they lived in a far-off country. I can imagine after that little peace treaty was signed that all the Gibeonites went around the corner on their way home and they're laughing and they're swatting each other on the back saying, oh, what a dumb leader that Joshua is. How gullible those Israelites are. Now, what is Joshua going to do when he discovers that his promise was made to people who live 20 minutes away? See, that's the point. I know what the congregation of Israel wanted to do. Look at verse 18. And the sons of Israel did not strike them. Well, that tells us they wanted to, because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. And the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. You've got Joshua now in the middle. The Israelites hate him, and the Gibeonites have made a fool out of him. Skip to verse 26. But thus he did to them, and delivered them from the hands of the sons of Israel, and they did not kill them. In other words, Joshua kept his promise. He responded with unusual character to the situation, knowing that if he did something wrong on top of the wrong that he had already done, it would never create a right, as you have well been told. Two wrongs don't make a right. But because Joshua responds with honesty and with character, what I want to show you is that by responding with character, Joshua creates, in a sense, the circumstances whereby God will respond, revealing his character through Joshua's life. He will do it in a very unusual way. Number one, God will use this alliance to bring swift and unexpected victory. Chapter 10, verse 1. Now it came about when Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had captured Ai and had utterly destroyed it, just as he'd done to Jericho and its king. Look at verse 2. That he feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all its men were mighty. Verse 3. Therefore, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent word to Hoam, king of Gibron, and to Piram, king of Jarmuth, and to Japhia, king of Lachish, and to Debir, king of England. I'm glad he got, or Eglon. Almost made it through it. Verse 4. Come up to me and help me, and let us attack Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the sons of Israel. In other words, this is a traitorous act. And this Gibeon is a strong and valiant city, and traitors somehow create the kind of circumstances where others will surrender, and it's contagious. If a mighty city will fall and surrender, wave the white flag, we'd better stamp them out, lest some smaller city-states will catch on, and the land literally lay down their arms to the Israelites. So they intend to go wipe them out and to destroy who used to be their friends. Verse 5. So the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered together and went up, they with all their armies, and camped by Gibeon and fought against it. Then the men of Gibeon sent word to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal, saying, "Do not abandon your servants." Now, here are the people that just fooled Joshua. "Do not abandon us. Come up as quickly and save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that live in the hill country have assembled against us." Now stop here. You're Joshua. Boy, this is a blessing. This is an answer to prayer that you've never prayed. Why not just sit back and let the Canaanites wipe out the Canaanites? Well, this promise was made, but, you know, the Lord will understand. And look, all the five kings come against them. It must be God at work in mysterious ways. But Joshua kept a promise that he made. That is, he responded with something that you and I might have rationalized ourselves out of. And the whole congregation of Israel would have patted Joshua on the back, and he would have once again been their hero. But what does he do? He mounts up. And verse 9 will tell us that Joshua came upon them suddenly by marching all night from Gilgal. That is, Joshua responded with character because Joshua was willing to keep his promise. And now God brings about victory over five kings. But he does it in an unusual way. Look at verse 10. And the Lord confounded them before Israel, and he slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and pursued them by the way of the ascent of Beth-horon, and struck them as far as Azek and Makeda. And it came about as they fled from before Israel while they were at the descent of Beth-horon, that the Lord, note this, the Lord threw large stones from heaven on them as far as Azek, and they died. And there were more who died from the hailstones than those who the sons of Israel killed with a sword. Now, this might be a little strong for many people. The thought that I think the church has abandoned, the idea that God is a warrior who fights for his people, we have the idea that we're doing all the fighting. And it's all up to us. And we must be strong. My friend, God is powerful, and he is allowing his character to be revealed from a man or through a man and his nation who responded in character, and he fights. And there is God, the historical writer suggests, as it were, he's up in heaven throwing stones at the enemies of his people. This isn't the Jesus I know. The Jesus people know in this world are people who have a perception of him as being this pathetically weak figure who smells like hand lotion or something. He's a warrior. And he's up in heaven throwing stones because his people responded with character, and now he will fight for them. Very interesting picture. He is going to respond in like fashion. Now, there are times in our lives when people respond with character and we observe it and we admire it, and God, I think, wants to teach us how to respond in like fashion. Many of you have raised children. Sometimes I tell stories about mine, and you probably can identify because you've gone through the same thing. I had one of those expressions of great character and commitment from a five-year-old, one of my boys. Very convicting. We went to the doctor. Now, if you've been around here long enough, you know how I feel about doctors. It's not that I have anything against them. It's what they do. But I don't really like to go to their offices. And my son had been attacked by strep, as it was. And he was just flushed. His cheeks were red, and he had a high temperature, and just hot. He was just weak. And so at about 5:30, I got home, and Marcia had made an appointment with the doctor, and so I took him to the pediatrician's office. And, you know, I'm more nervous than he is, but we're sitting in there waiting, and finally the nurse comes and announces the name. I usually get clammy hands when they say, you know, Mr. Davey. And anyhow, we get up and we walk in, and we walk into this waiting room that's all tile and everything echoes, and we're sitting there and we're waiting for the nurse. And finally she arrives and looks him over, and then she says, well, what we need to do is a check just to make sure it's strep. And so what I ought to do is take some samples from his throat. And so she says, open up, and of course he opens up and she gouges, that's my word, but kind of gouges down there, and he's gagging, you know, and I'm over here gagging too with him. She does that twice, and oh, I feel so bad for him, and I'm kind of identifying, and then she leaves, and we're sitting there. I said, you know, why don't you come get on my lap? So he's kind of on my lap. He's wiped out. And I'm kind of whistling a little softly, and he says, Dad, let's sing. So what do you want to sing? He said, let's sing Hallelujah. Here. This is a doctor's office. You don't sing Hallelujah. You're a doctor. Yeah. I didn't tell him that. I thought that. So we sing Hallelujah. It's echoing. You know, the door's open. And get to the end of that verse. And he said, let's sing another stanza or another verse. I said, what do you want to sing? And he said, let's sing I Love Jesus. Now, I'm standing in front of strangers, and I don't wink an eyelash at saying what I believe I ought to say. And I talk to total strangers about Jesus Christ. But at that particular moment, you know, it went through my mind. I'll admit to you. How could I shut that door without my son knowing? And since he was in my lap, I couldn't get over there and, you know, shut it. And so there we are. I love Jesus. People are walking back and forth. It's echoing all over the place. I said, Lord, you know, I got the picture. I've learned what an evidence, in a sense, of his own innocent, but yet deep for him, character. When you see it evidenced in the life of a nation, it's interesting to see how God responds, and he will do basically two revelations of himself. Revelation number one is that God is the warrior who fights for the faithful, and that leads me to the second, that God is the creator who controls his creation. I love this next passage. Look at verse 12. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel, and he said in the sight of Israel, in other words, the nation can hear. And Joshua is praying one of those public prayers. And he says, O sun, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon in the valley of Ajalon. Verse 13, so the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves of their enemies. What's the problem here? Well, what's going on is Joshua is in the midst of defeating five kingdoms. He knows that this is an unusual evidence of God's power, and it's getting dark. He needs more daylight to finish this mopping up. And he has the audacity to ask God to give him more daylight. Now, God has never answered that prayer when I have prayed it. He is basically saying, I need about 12 more hours of daylight. And God does. Now, I usually don't take time to answer the critics, but I have to address this one issue because you may confront or be confronted with it where you work. This is a passage that everybody loves to run to. Oh, we know now. Inspiration couldn't be. How unscientific to say, oh, sun, stand still. We know that the sun doesn't stand still, or I should say move. We know it's the earth that moves around the sun, and as it moves, it rotates, giving us the 24-hour, the 12-hour cycles. We know that's how it operates. The sun is basically in the center. So for Joshua to stand and say, oh sun, stand still, that's a pretty big boo-boo in the scriptures. Can't get around that one. Well, I would take the same critic, and he might be with him sometime, and he's seated, and maybe he's looking out over the lake, and he sees the beautiful scenery that God is painting him. What would he say? Isn't the sunset beautiful? The sun who? You notice when it goes down, the beautiful colors, it goes where? See, that is our perspective, and that's how we talk. In fact, you can turn on your weather channel, and it will tell you the hour and the minute of sunset and the hour and minute of sunrise. Unscientific? Yeah. But that's how we talk. Basically, that's how Joshua was talking in the language of his day, then we still talk that way today. He is, in effect, saying, God, I need a longer day so that I can finish this job. It's interesting, the Dallas Morning News, August 14th, 1972, reported an incident discovered by scientists that an explosion on the sun's surface had created a slower rotation of the earth, making a very long day. Now, whether we had that or not, is God powerful enough to order the creation? You see, my friends, if the world could just believe Genesis chapter 1 and what happened in chapter 1, they would have no trouble believing anything else in the book. But that's the stumbling block. Now look at the last part of verse 13. Is it not written in the book of Jashar? That's a collection of great events in Israel's history that's mentioned even in the book of 1 Samuel. And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. Now, can you figure that out? No. Can you explain it? No, you can explain it away. And my research uncovered about 21 different ways to explain it away. But if God is big enough to create, he is big enough to order. Donald Gray Barnhouse, who was a tremendous expositor of the Word, who has affected your life probably indirectly. He is a man who influenced his young protege by the name of Howard Hendricks. Howard Hendricks has gone on to influence men who you have probably heard speak, Chuck Swindoll and Stanley, who have written, and this man was a very unique illustrator. But anyhow, he came back to Princeton Seminary on one occasion, and he preached to that student body, and the faculty appeared, and Robert Dick Wilson, who happened to be an Old Testament scholar at the seminary, a believer, came to listen. And he came up to Barnhouse after the sermon, and he said, look, I just come and hear my boys one time. He said, if you come back, I won't come back. I just want to come and hear one time the boys that graduate that have sat under me, because I want to know if they have a little God or a big God. Robert Dick Wilson went on to talk about those who have a little God have a lot of trouble with God. He can't do miracles. He can't take care of inspiration or preservation. He has difficulty ordering the world. And he said, there are those who have a big God. He speaks, and it is done. He commands, and it is accomplished. And Robert Dick Wilson said, Mr. Barnhouse, you have a very big God. For those who have a big God, this passage doesn't even cause a hiccup. Now, there is one more thing that I want to note about this miracle before going on, and that is the sun and moon. This is interesting because in the Canaanite pagan religion, guess who two of their chief deities are? The sun and the moon. And so by performing this miracle, God in effect sent a message that I am more powerful than your chief gods. I can control them. Now I said that God would do two things because of Joshua's character. That is, he would allow Joshua to experience unexpected victory, number one. And secondly, and I want to lead to that now, he will use this alliance to influence the Gibeonites for his glory. I want you to go back to chapter 9 and look at the insight of Joshua as he places them into service. Look at verse 27. But Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord to this day, in the place which he should choose. You notice that? Where did Joshua assign them to serve? The altar. If you're going to serve, You're going to hew wood for the altar, and you're going to bring water, and you're going to come many times a day. Joshua, in effect, says, I am going to expose you to the worship of Yahweh. And what happened? If you put the pieces together in the Old Testament, you'll discover something very fascinating. And it is this: the Gibeonites came to follow Yahweh themselves. Let me give you some of those clues. Number one, when the Jews in later years went off to follow after false gods, the Gibeonites refused to go. When the land was divided, they chose Gibeon as the city where the altar was placed and where Aaron and the priests resided. So that would become a special sacred city. 400 years after the land was divided, David built the tabernacle in Gibeon. About 500 years before Christ, in the time of Zerubbabel, the genealogies talk about those that returned to Jerusalem at the Babylonian exile, and guess who they list as being followers of God returning to Jerusalem? The Gibeonites. One of the most interesting clues that I uncovered was the fact that when Nehemiah went back to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, guess who volunteered to go back and help him rebuild the walls? The Gibeonites. Exposure to worship, exposure to a man who responded in a way that probably surprised them. Joshua could have left them to hang. He could have said, well, God, thank you for bringing along these five kings to wipe out an embarrassing situation. But yet they saw Joshua and his men cover in a nighttime what took them 3 hours to cover earlier to come to their rescue. And I have no doubt that that amazed them. An exposure to the power and the might of God, a personal God, eventually worked in the Gibeonites and brought them to faith in him as well. My friend, you may be surrounded by Gibeonites. You probably work with a few. You may be married to one. Your son or daughter might be a Gibeonite. We live next door to one. Oh, if we could keep our testimonies uncluttered and clear that respond and reveal character, we will then allow the circumstances whereby God can reveal his character to us and through us. And the Gibeonites around us, who knows, may honor him too. How do the Gibeonites in your world view you?